Father William Bennett has been a priest in the Episcopal Church for 23 years and has served in parishes on Long Island, Brooklyn, New York City, and in North Carolina. During part of that time, he was a worker priest and supported himself through a career in finance, providing capital for telecommunications and media companies. For the past 4 years, he's been a monk in the Order of the Holy Cross, a Benedictine community in the Episcopal Church, which has monasteries here in Santa Barbara, in Berkeley, West Park, New York, Toronto, and Grahamstown in Eastern Cape Province of the Republic of South Africa. He's a native South Carolinian, a historian and an avid reader of British mysteries, and we are delighted to have him, so let's greet him with a warm welcome, and then we'll stand and sing a blessing over us. I can see that Tom has his recorder here, so it's a little late, but is that okay if we record you?
What am I going to say, no?
There you go. Okay, let's hope that. Okay.
People. I had to say that because I was preaching on Sunday and with a sound system that I wasn't used to, and every time I said a P, because I've been very well trained to pronounce them properly, the sound system exploded. it was popping with my peas, and so that way everyone at the sermon stayed awake. Thank you very much for including me in your time today. I was going to wear my habit, but we wear a white habit. And when I went to look at it in the closet this morning, it wasn't white. Because if you remember, Sunday it was raining, so it had most of the parking lot on the lower third of it. And the other thing I've learned wearing the habit is I can't get close to a cup of coffee because it was all down the front. So I dress this way most of the time, so you get to see me the way I really look. I'm glad we started with that psalm refrain this morning, because I wanted to focus our attention at the beginning on that psalm. It comes from Psalm 94, Psalm 95, depending on which numbering system you're using. The Latin name of the psalm is Venite Exultimus, or as we say in Anglicanism, the Venite. This English Latin pronunciation is very strange. They have things like the Benedicite, you know. So the Venite. And it's the great invitatory psalm, which traditionally begins the day's prayer. It's the first psalm of the first of the liturgy of the hours, whatever that may be. If you begin with the liturgy of vigils, you begin with this psalm in its entirety. If the first prayer you pray is morning prayer or lauds, the tradition is to begin with that. And I thought I would read the entire psalm so that we can pray it together, because it's an interesting psalm and I think very helpful for what we're talking about today. Come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us shout for joy to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before God's presence with thanksgiving and raise a loud shout to him with psalms. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In his hand are the caverns of the earth, and the heights of the hills are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands have molded the dry land. Come, let us bow down and bend the knee and kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Oh, that today you would hearken to his voice. Harden not your hearts, as your forebears did in the wilderness, at Meribah, and on that day at Massah, when they tempted me. They put me to the test, though they had seen my works. 40 years long I detested that generation and said, this people are wayward in their hearts. They do not know my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. Now this psalm begins as a hymn of praise to the God who creates us and who remains always our strength. God is called the Rock, a symbol of permanence and power. But it's also an allusion, as the psalm points out, to the rock at Massah and Meribah along the Exodus road, which gave water. So the rock is not only a symbol of strength, but it's a symbol of God's outpouring of life upon us. What I find curious is that the psalm's voice changes between the two halves of our refrain. Oh, that today you would hearken to his voice, ends the first half of the psalm, and the first speaker, we who are the speaker. Then begins the second speaker, God's voice speaking, with the command, harden not your hearts, lest you be like those at Meribah and Massah. Not to turn our hearts into stone, as our forebears did at that great rock which stood at the foot of Mount Horeb, on the Exodus road. There, they despaired of their freedom and cried out to Moses, is the Lord among us or not? Things were better off in slavery in Egypt. And Moses, who had been commanded already by God to strike the rock to give life-giving water, in his anger struck the rock. And the water did flow forth. And the place from that day on was named Massah and Meribah, i.e., test and strife, because they tested God there. Now, I think this is an important image for us to keep in our minds as we work through this chapter together. In the introduction, Brutteau talks about the importance of religious metaphor, here, the image of the rock, and the importance of the perspective that one has when one looks on that metaphor or object. At first, it's simply a thing over there, but gradually, as we practice contemplation, our perspective changes, and we find that the rock is not just a piece of hard granite. It is rather capable of being injured, struck, breaking open, and gushing forth the life-giving tears of water in whatever desert we find ourselves. And part of the journey into stillness and contemplation is a journey not unlike the Exodus, in which our perspective will change. A simple object will become a doorway into connection with the infinite, with the necessary, with the eternal. And it did so, curiously enough, in the folklore of Israel. Eventually, people came to speak of this miraculous, life-giving rock, which from that day to the end of the Exodus, followed the children of Israel, our Exodus forebears, through their desert journey, providing with, whenever they stopped, providing them with the water whenever it was needed. And St. Paul picks up on this tradition when he talks of this event in 1 Corinthians 10. He talks of the rock following the people, and he makes this statement: "For they drank from the spiritual rock, the rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." The rock was Christ. Such a change in perspective, a movement deep into the reality of the eternal. And that's the movement that Brutteau is inviting us into. She begins our chapter, and let me just say one word of preface here. You could say that I do this kind of stuff for a living. And I found that I had to read this book very closely. I was complaining to a brother this morning, why did she have to use the word ineluctably? I had to go to the big dictionary to look it up. It simply means inescapably. So there was a good word that would have worked there. So if you find this rough going, I appreciate it, because I've had to work very hard on this chapter. But it's worth working hard on, is the point I want to make. She begins this chapter by saying, and I quote her, "The most important thing in initiating a contemplative attitude towards life is being still and open." And she identifies this as involving relaxation and silence. The kinds of, as she describes it so wonderfully, the kinds of not doing so essential to the contemplative life. Now let's say a word about leisure, which was the subject of the last chapter. Certainly it means relaxation and rest and Sabbath and peace. But in the monastic tradition in which I'm immersed, it is associated not just with a certain time of leisure, although we do have times when we're not working, but it is associated with everything that we do. The Latin word here is otium, O-T-I-U-M. And I've just noticed that Thistle Hotels run a chain of health and leisure spas called Otium. But otium is a noun that means ease, inactivity, freedom from business, rest, peace, and this is the important one, time enough for everything. That your life is organized in such a way, you build its rhythms so that you have time enough for everything. You don't have to push anything to one side. And in the wonderful way of Latin, it is not only a noun, it is also an adverb. And that adverb means leisurely. Time enough for everything at a leisurely pace. That is part of the prescription for contemplative living as we live the rhythm of life. Now, for those at the monastery, it mostly comes more easily, but it is something that is attainable for everyone. So let your leisure be part of all of your living, that you find time enough for everything and to do it at a leisurely pace. Settle into it. And part of the rhythm is at times stillness. For us at the monastery, much of the day is spent in silence. The evening is silent from after compline, which we pray at 8 o'clock, and half of it is silent, until after breakfast the next morning at 8:30. But what I find is that silence begins to permeate the day, at least my day, and I find that I speak a whole lot less. I don't engage in the sort of normal chatter that people do. I always tell guests, it's all right not to say good morning. You can acknowledge each other's presence in other ways. And I find sometimes that I often don't speak during the entire day, except at the Liturgy of the Hours or at the Eucharistic Assembly. And this rhythm, which is punctuated by silence and stillness, helps create a relaxation of the body, as Brotteau describes it, as well as a relaxation of the heart. Don't ever forget that your heart literally is a very powerful muscle, and it can be tensed as well as all the other muscles of your system. And she encourages us to help it relax as well. And this relaxation creates a sense of availability for God, to be able to recognize God's murmuring in your heart, and also in the hearts of all those around you. A lot of times we think of the contemplative journey as trying to find God or to make God available to us. Well, God's not lost. And it's actually the other way around. If anyone's lost, we are. And if anyone needs to become available, we do. God's waiting for us to make ourselves available, to hear Him speaking, to find ourselves awash in the water of His love. And Brotteau presents the argument that a body which is relaxed is related to a more relaxed outlook on life, to generosity, to unselfishness, to trust, to rejoicing in the other's good rather than my own, to the ability to love, to respect, to fellowship. Once you adopt that less hard attitude, your muscles tend to relax all the time, and they are less hard, including the all-important heart. Now, the first section of the chapter is called Relaxing the Body. She writes that the first step in stillness is very prosaically and humbly the relaxation of bodily tensions. Insofar as these are tied to emotional tensions, the two will have to relax together. But we may be able to get at the body more easily. It's sometimes harder to get at the emotional level. And she warns us first off about a temptation to see why we can't do it. And she encourages us to acknowledge that temptation, I would suggest, but just put it down. And instead to respond to the invitation to talk about our own capacity to experience relaxation, and to encourage an expectation that you will, in fact, experience it. You know, St. Ignatius encourages in his spiritual exercises for us to be really aware of our own desires. What is it you desire? Is one of the constant Ignatian questions. It's coupled with, what is your condition? And I think that's important here. Acknowledge what your condition is. Acknowledge where you are tense and where this you're holding on to this hardness. And then to believe that your desire can be fulfilled. And be honest about your desire, because if your desire needs reshaping, God will do that for you as you enter the process honestly. Now, she acknowledges that there are many methods of what she calls unlearning tension habits and replacing them with another term of hers, appropriate tone habits, which is to say the right and comfortable level of tension for the particular situation. You have to have some tension in your body, otherwise you couldn't walk. You know, if you were just completely relaxed muscles, you would be a heap on the floor all of the time, and that's not what God wants from us. But it needs to be appropriate, right for the particular level. For instance, if you're in a fearful situation, you should A, feel fear, and your body will tense up to help you be on guard for that fear. But you don't need to walk around all of your life, probably, in that fearful, tensed position. Now, she suggests that there are many of them, many methods for doing this, but she doesn't name them. For me, I find it very helpful. One of the things to do is to engage in the Ignatian examination of consciousness every day, which some of you may be familiar with, but there are plenty of resources to find out about it. And in part, it helps me look at my day in gratitude, also to look at my day realistically, to see how I reacted in certain situations, whether that was appropriate or not, whether it was a reaction or a response accepting God's love in the day, or whether it was in fact a chance where I actually rejected God's love, even though I thought I might be doing the right thing. It's a chance to see those moments when you'd like to do it over. And just accept the fact that it happened that way, but learn from it. And while the other thing I would suggest is that while stillness of the heart is the object of our desire, don't neglect to keep your body in shape as you are able to do that. I find that regular exercise of some form, something quite so simple as walking, or strength training, which you can do with a couple of cans of canned peaches, you know, just doing your arms. Other people find that yoga is helpful. I also do a form of Tai Chi called Tai Chi Chi, which helps me retain the focus on the presence, and also it relaxes me. It's very good at relaxing me and keeping me in the present, because if my thoughts wander, I fall down. or I fall out of the move. And the moves can't be done tense. You have to relax in order to do the move. So I do suggest keeping that aware, adding some form of exercise to your life. You'll also find that a lot of repetitive exercise is a great place to be praying. On my morning walk, I don't know how many repetitions of the Jesus Prayer I'm able to pray. It also has a utilitarian purpose. It keeps my pace at the right level. But I was telling someone about that the other day, and she said, oh, killing two birds with one stone. And I said, well, yeah, I guess it works, though. She talks about three principles which are important in learning to relax the body and that also remain important throughout the contemplative experience. So you should spend some time with these three principles. The first is understand. Understand what's going on in your life and how your system, your body, your life system, how they all operate. And how our bodily states and our emotional states are related. Ignatius would say the question is, what is your condition? Not what is it that you want it to be, but what is it right now? You can only start where you are. So understand your reality and that you're not a bunch of disparate parts. You're an interlocking system and that everything affects your body. I once had an ingrown toenail and it really hurt. And I discovered, for instance, that when your toe or your feet hurt, your whole body hurts. And when you're, and not just your whole body, but your whole life hurts. And not just your life, but you're easily cross with those whom you most love. I couldn't have cared less about my prayer life. What I did have was probably the healthiest thing I did was I was able to sit there and yell at God about how bad I felt. But we're interlocked organisms, mind, body, and spirit. And the condition of one affects the condition of all of us. Her second principle after understanding is that we should have a wholehearted determination to move into the new state, not a half-hearted, tentative attitude. Don't hold anything back. Don't say, well, I'll try it, but it probably won't work. You have to dive in. That's what she says by wholehearted. And again, a word about heart. Classically, and in the time of Jesus and much of our spiritual tradition, only until recently did this change, the heart was the seat of thinking, of understanding, of all of our emotions, and of all our actions. And it was this part of your body. It wasn't just the organ. It probably had as much to do with your liver in ancient minds as anything else. That's why it's called the liver. It's where you live. But that our intelligence and feeling and resolve all lay in this part of the body. Now, where do you think? And where do you love? We've split them. This is a legacy from the Enlightenment. Also, when we began to discover that the brain did have some role in all of this. But we split apart thinking and feeling, the resolve for action and feeling. So this journey into the heart will help to create a unified center of your life. And, you know, I don't care where you locate it. It could be in your big toe. But the important thing is to put your thinking and your feeling and your acting back together in the same center. The good news is that people who are younger than us, the Gen Xers and on down, the Gen Ys and the whatever the new one is, don't seem to have as much a problem about this as we do. We are very good children of the Enlightenment. But we are, it might appear, to be the last gasp of the Enlightenment. And that's one of the reasons for so much of the struggle, I think, that's going on within our faith tradition right now. The Enlightenment doesn't want to let go. The curious thing is that some of the studies are indicating that these younger people who've all grown up with computers and the internet as a normal part of their lives are able to be reunified because of that. They have no difficulty knowing about the reality of an alternative reality, an unseen reality, because they live in it all the time. They have virtual communities, which are real communities to them, all over the world, which are fueled in part by their ability to imagine. It's a very different way of thinking that's emerging. And I keep trying to keep my finger connected, but it's very, very hard. So, the final thing, understand, wholehearted determination, and then the final principle, anyone remember what it is?
Practice.
Not just once. Practice, 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 practice. Hear your mother's voice telling you to go practice the scales of the piano. You can't learn this until you practice. Because it's to become a habit. And you don't pick up a habit by doing it once. It becomes habitual. And for it to become habitual, it has to be the place you inhabit, the place where you live. So it has to become as normal as getting up every morning. And to do that, you have to train yourself. So be patient with yourself, but do it every day. Do it some way every hour. No exceptions. No excuses. Practice. Because the contemplative, and all of us are contemplative, the contemplative aims to train, to tame the body, to keep it healthy and calm and well-regulated. And this language she's using here is the ancient, ancient language in our tradition of asceticism, of discipline. It's the language that we read about from all of the spiritual guides, from John the Baptist to Jesus to the Amas and Abbas in the Egyptian desert up until our own day. Some form of exercise, plain diet, within reason. The avoidance, and this is really important, I've discovered in my own journey, the avoidance of stimulating or depressing chemicals. And remember that the two most widely used stimulants in this country are caffeine and nicotine. And the most widely used depressant is alcohol. So living a balance between those extremes is really important. And within your own life, you will find what she calls a pacifying rhythm of life as fitted to the rhythms of nature. It's somewhat difficult to achieve at first, but have the sense that as you order your day, and that you are ordering your day, you are in charge of the shape of your day, not the other way around. But as you order your day, strive for regularity as far as possible. It's really helpful to get up at the same time every day, because your body develops its rhythm. And to eat, and they tell us actually, the dietitians, that eating as closely as possible at the same time each day is important for helping to set this body's clock. So look for what's regular in your day, not for what interrupts it. The interruptions will come, but look for what's regular to establish the rhythm. And then there comes the point where it's necessary to keep the body still. Now, we're not talking about 24 hours a day here, but to spend some time each day when your body is still. First, we're talking about it in two senses. The first one is to keep silence by not speaking aloud, and also not to have a lot of extraneous noise. We had a guest not long ago come to the monastery, and before the silence began at 8 o'clock at night, she had to leave because just the afternoon was too silent. because there wasn't a radio playing, and the television wasn't playing in the other room, and the phone wasn't ringing all the time, and already the silence was too hard. So if your life is filled with sound, wean yourself off the sound gradually. If you were to cut it all out, all at once, it will be too hard because you're used to its companionship. But wean yourself slowly and find what's interesting then is who can be your companion in the silence. The other way of being still is not just the aural stillness, the stillness in your ears, but also the stillness in motion. To hold still in a prayer or meditation posture without moving. Now, I always tell people that that posture preeminently needs to be comfortable. Don't make it something that you're putting tension back into your body. Many people find it very helpful to pray in a very comfortable chair. So once you locate that most comfortable place in your house, pray there. Pray, and again, most people also find that it's helpful to sit with both of your feet on the floor when you're trying to do this, because crossing your ankles, crossing your legs, both, I just realized I crossed them backwards from each other, both put tension into your body. So sit as relaxed as possible. Many people find to sit with your palms up in the posture of reception, on balanced on the tops of your legs, which, by the way, these are the more powerful muscles in your body. These are almost as important as the heart in keeping everything going. So rest your muscles, your hands there. But if this feels awkward, then try this way. It doesn't really matter. Find a posture in which you're comfortable. Because the idea is to make tensions and distractions cease. Breathing is important. While it's important to breathe deeply and regularly, I always tell people when I'm conducting a retreat with them like this, focus on breathing out. Breathe out as far down, from as far down in your lungs as you're capable. Because you don't have to worry then about breathing in. That breath is going to come naturally, just the same way that God's love and God's mercy come naturally into our lives, if we make ourselves available. So make yourself available by breathing out. It's okay to make noise there, you know. And it just comes back in. So focus on your breathing and regularity. And it will actually slow down during this process. And this also has demonstrable effects on the nervous and endocrine systems. When I was growing up, I heard people speak disparagingly about folks known as the navel gazers. And I didn't know what that was, but I knew statues of the Buddha generally had a big navel, and so I decided that it was the Buddhists who were navel gazers staring at the Buddha's navel. Does anyone know what the term comes from? It comes from our tradition. It has nothing to do with Buddhism at all. It has to do with a group of monks in Eastern Orthodoxy called the Hesychasts, who popularized the Jesus prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior, have mercy on me, a sinner. And they described praying it, and as you prayed it, one of the things that happened is you let your head fall forward. And their enemies ridiculed them by saying that they were a bunch of navel gazers. But there's something that happens when your head falls forward like that, because when it falls forward, your eyes roll up in your head, and it sets off a brainwave process which makes you more meditative but also alert at the same time. So there is a physical change going on in your body that opens you, that your body gets in on the act and helps make you available for God's love. So next time you hear navel gazers, smile. Because we find ourselves in a condition that's balanced between relaxation and alertness, neither too little or neither too much. Because you let go both of your restlessness and drowsiness. Now there's some hints about this. Don't do it when you're sleepy. You'll only fall asleep, which is what you need to be doing at that moment. I used to try to get up earlier before I'd go to work to pray, and I would always fall asleep, and I finally figured this out, that I needed more sleep, not more praying at that point. So be aware of that. Don't do it when you're sleepy, because you'll fall asleep. The corollary of that, then, is get enough rest. That's very important. Find a regular place in your house. Find a regular time. Remember, you're in control of your day, not all the other forces you have surrendered control to. Many people find it helpful, perhaps, to light a candle at the beginning of their time of stillness, just to be conscious of sanctifying that time and of sanctifying what is ordinarily an ordinary part of your house. But the truth of the matter is, that's where you're going to find God, in the ordinariness of our lives, not in the extraordinary. And then your mind is going to be full of distractions. Those of you who practice centering prayer know what I'm talking about. Distraction after distraction after distraction comes. Don't fight them. If you fight them, they get stronger. Acknowledge them. I anthropomorphize them. I turn them into little human beings and say, well, thank you for reminding me of that, but I don't want to... I'll deal with that later. And I have a little shelf, literally a little shelf in my imagination that I put them on. You know, so do that. But they're going to come, so don't fight them. There's a wonderful story, I think, told about Thomas Keating, who was teaching centering prayer. And this religious sister came up to him afterwards and said, oh, Father, I'm no good at this kind of praying. In that half hour, I must have had 1,000 distracting thoughts. To which he said, not, you're right, you're no good at this. He said, how wonderful, 1,000 opportunities to return to the Lord. Mm-hmm. Look at what you can do, mm-hmm. not at what you can't do. And practice, practice, practice. There are many methods, and you'll find out which is the ones that are important to you. It's now 11 o'clock. We'll have to take our little break, and I'll continue a little bit when we get back. I find that I have more to say about this chapter than I originally thought. So I'll see you in 15 minutes.